The Rich and Powerful, exposed today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A massive data leak is embarrassing many of the globe's richest and most powerful people. From presidents to soccer stars, they seem to be hiding their money in Panama, and they've just been busted.
When you've been caught with your pants down in such a blatant manner, I don't think there's a whole lot you can really say on this. The documents prove the story.
One of those caught in the scandal is Iceland's prime minister, and now Icelanders want to know why he's been telling them to keep their money in domestic banks.
Why is the prime minister, why had he for years been acting in contradiction to his own economic policies?
Plus, why Panama? Think geography and weak legal institutions. We dive deep into the Panama Papers today on The World. Thanks for being with us on this Monday. So where do the rich go to get help avoiding taxes? Switzerland, the Caymans, Singapore, tax shelters these places are called. Panama is one too, and we were reminded of that this weekend thanks to a leak of millions of documents from a Panamanian law firm. The documents are being called the Panama Papers, and they seem to show that one law firm, Mossack Fonseca, was essentially showing clients how to set up shell companies to camouflage their money. Today on the show, we'll be looking into a few of Mossack Fonseca's clients. There's a Russian cellist who's one of Vladimir Putin's oldest friends, also the prime minister of Iceland, who now faces an angry public back home. Oh, and also global soccer superstar Lionel Messi, to name just three. But we want to start today with this question: why Panama? James Cooper is with the California Western School of Law in San Diego. I gather you weren't that surprised that this is happening, James Cooper. What is it about Panama, specifically Panama, that wasn't a surprise to you?
Well, Panama has long been the site of much corruption, political intrigue, and financial exchange. It's ranked 72 out of 168 in the Transparency International Index. There's a reason the canal was built there. It's highly strategic in the Americas. It's a political and a financial space largely created by a set of events when it broke off from Colombia that are suspicious. It's a place that connects Latin America with the rest of the world and connects South and North America together. And it's far closer to Europe than any other Latin American capital cities. It's got lots of businesses and people from Asia ready to do business, and it's a global hotspot for international financial transactions.
Yeah, so is there anything different in Panama from, say, the Cayman Islands? Why would one government official or celebrity millionaire choose Panama over, say, the banks in the Caymans?
Well, part of its language, although English increasingly is the language for banking, but also financial transactions globally in general. But the other reason is it's got the ability to move things back and forth without full know-your-client regulations like what they're instituting in Switzerland. There are a number of different levels of scrutiny that banks can go through and uses of shell companies and so forth and number companies. There's just an amazing array of legal tools that law firms have to hide clients' money.
For some Americans, Panama still is exemplified by Manuel Noriega, former strongman there, now serving time in a prison. But since he was overthrown in that U.S. operation in 1989, what has been kind of the big trends that turned Panama into this hub for all kinds of financial, legal, and now it seems illegal stuff?
Well, first is the repatriation of profit laws that exist in certain countries, the kinds of financial transactions that exist under loopholes in tax treaties, under reporting, weak institutions that are open to political influence, and a culture of looking the other way. This is how economies are built in some respect. Think about Paraguay and the counterfeit business, or think about other institutions that are rather other countries that have these kinds of reputations for illicit activities.
How much of what has been leaked out of Mossack Fonseca that you've read and checked out, how much of it looks suspicious and illegal?
Oh, there are innumerable international tax treaties that are going to apply to what's going on. There are going to be reporting requirements that are going to get triggered. There are going to be investigations into money laundering. There are going to be investigations into illicit transactions and the kind of working with the most nefarious criminal organizations in the world, and likewise heads of state. There are so many people involved in this. The real question is, how are they going to, and who is going to start the prosecution? There's no shortage of jurisdictions that are going to take an interest in what's going on.
How many Mossack Fonsecas are there down in Panama? Are we just looking at the tip of the iceberg here?
There are a number of international law firms. There are tax agencies. There are accounting institutions, some of them very, very famous, that do this kind of work. It's only periodically that we get to talk about it. It's not the most particularly sexy topic, but financial regulation is where a lot of investigation, a lot of enforcement action can take place.
James Cooper there. He teaches at California Western School of Law. Russians feature prominently in these Panama Papers. None of the documents examined so far connects Vladimir Putin directly, but plenty of his friends seem to be there, including a famous cellist, Sergei Roldugin. He apparently controls multiple companies worth billions of dollars in offshore tax havens. Yes, a cellist. Drew Sullivan is editor and co-founder of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. That's one of the news organizations that's been examining the Panama Papers for the past year. The group's just published an in-depth article on Roldugin.
He's one of Putin's oldest friends, actually. They go back many, many years to before even Putin was in the KGB. They grew up together in what was then Leningrad, St. Petersburg now, and they used to fight on the streets together. They stayed a lot together. They would hang out each other with each other all the time. So he really is one of his oldest friends.
Is Roldugin rich?
Well, he claims not to be. You know, he's told the New York Times, "I'm not a millionaire." He's kind of self-effacing and basically gives the air of someone who's just a veteran musician and not one of the oligarchs that are going around driving big cars and living in very nice houses.
So in your project's article on Roldugin, you call him the caretaker. Why is that?
Well, that was a description used by one of his friends. And, you know, essentially what people who are close to Putin know is that, you know, Putin will never have any documents with his name on it. He's just too smart of a guy and he's a world leader. He knows he can't do that. So he most likely uses people like Sergei to hold his assets for him or to basically be his proxy.
Is there anything to suggest that Sergei Roldugin, this Russian cellist, is doing all of this on his own?
Well, no, he does none of it on his own. It's actually done mostly by a couple employees who work for Bank Russia, which is the bank that is called the Bank of Putin's Friends in Russia. And it's a large, profitable bank that seems to have almost managing this whole affair for Sergei Roldugin. And when we talked with Sergei, he had no idea, really. He almost seemed to be foggy about what these companies were and what these transactions were. And so the suspicion is that, of course, you know, he has no idea what's going on. This is, they're just using his name and he signs documents.
How surprised are you by any or all of this?
Well, I won't say I'm surprised by what's happening. I mean, we estimate that Putin is worth probably around $200 billion that he's taken from the Russian economy over the years. And we knew that this was happening. We're very familiar with these types of techniques. They're used all over Eastern Europe and the former CIS states. So that's not surprising. What is surprising is to actually get all the documents, all the evidence, and how really blatant and audacious this was. You know, it's amazing how many records there are and how many cases that you have to do. I mean, when you're stealing, you know, $1 million, that's one thing. When you're stealing $1 billion, you know, that's a whole operation. That's, you know, it's money laundering. It's a lot of transactions. It's a lot of paperwork.
With all those records, I mean, the Kremlin says today the documents contained, quote, nothing concrete and nothing new, end quote, and nothing to implicate Putin. What do you think about that?
Well, that's a pretty surprising statement. I mean, to have documents that prove that at the very least there's kind of money laundering going on, that would be kind of the minimal crime here. To say that this is not new is pretty surprising. I mean, I think when you've been caught with your pants down in such a blatant manner, I don't think there's a whole lot you can really say on this. The documents prove the story.
Drew Sullivan, editor and co-founder of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
More coverage of the Panama Papers leak later on the show. Stay with us. Hundreds of thousands of migrants from the Middle East, North Africa, and beyond headed for Europe over the past year. And recently, the European Union and Turkey signed a controversial deal to stem that flow. Today, that deal went into effect, and Europe started sending migrants back. More than 200 people were sent by ship from Greece back to Turkey. Correspondent Daniela Ceslo was there in the Turkish port town of Dikili to witness the scene. Afterwards, she spoke with me from the airport in Izmir and described what she saw.
Well, Marco, I got to the waterfront at about 8:30 this morning, and we started to see the first of three ferries that was coming in from the Greek islands, bringing a total of about 200 people over. And these were people who Europe had said did not qualify for refugee status, mostly Pakistani. And so we saw them getting off the boat and getting onto police buses and then transported away from Dikili and further north in Turkey.
So you said most of these people were Pakistani. That was pretty much the full array of people who were on the boat?
Yeah, it was mostly Pakistanis, but also people from Afghanistan, Iran, and Congo, and Sri Lanka, which is what the AP reported, along with two Syrians, reportedly, who asked to be voluntarily deported.
So how does one qualify to stay in Europe? How do you establish a legitimate claim?
Well, first of all, there are certain countries that Europe has determined are safe countries, and therefore their residents are considered economic migrants. Their nationals are considered economic migrants. So that's what happened with the Pakistanis, where last month Europe declared that they were no longer welcome. And then the Syrians obviously have a claim as war refugees. And then nationals of other countries, it's kind of on an individual case-by-case basis.
And for Syrians, the deal is for each Syrian returned, one Syrian migrant in Turkey will be resettled in the EU. Is that correct?
Those are the terms of the deal. So in Turkey today, there are reports of just under three dozen Syrians who were meant to be making their way over to Hanover in Germany. And so with time, the numbers of Syrians leaving Turkey should be rising as the number of migrants coming from Europe to Turkey rises as well.
Are Pakistanis and Afghans, are non-Syrians, upset with this deal?
Of course. You know, I was in Lesbos last month, and I met Pakistanis who had just gotten off the boats. They had come in on the rubber dinghies, smuggled over from Turkey. And basically, while they were on their journey from Pakistan over to Europe, the rules had changed. And so there were several hundred who were on Lesbos when I was there, and they were so frustrated. They felt like they had sold their homes often, spent their life savings, risked their lives to cross the seas, and by the time they arrived, the goalposts had moved, and they were no longer qualified to seek any sort of new life in Europe. So this is really the end of a big dream for a lot of people who are now realizing that Europe is shutting its doors.
Yeah, so for these people, for all the people who are sent back to Turkey, what are they going to do now? Where will they go?
The people we met today were quickly boarded on buses. We didn't have a chance to interview them. The police were quite closed about the operation. They were taken on police buses and taken to a place 450 kilometers to the north near Turkey's border with Greece. And there they were said to be going to processing centers. Turkey is supposed to be building also a new facility that will have capacity for around 70,000 migrants. At the moment, it's an empty field. And the end game for the people who are returned to Turkey is not yet 100% clear. And I think that will be something that will be worked out in the next weeks and months.
Is there any possibility that some of these people will just be fed up with this struggle and just head back to where they came from, regardless of how violent that place is?
Certainly. I mean, we've heard reports already of Iraqis leaving Germany in frustration. I met an Afghan 2 days ago in Istanbul who was saying also he came initially thinking that he would be able to start a new life. It's been 4 years and he hasn't been able to get a work permit. He is a waiter in a restaurant in a trendy neighborhood of Istanbul and he lives in fear of the immigration police. And so I think that for a lot of people, seeing their options narrow with this new EU-Turkey deal is starting to open up thoughts about maybe home wasn't so bad.
Daniela Ceslo in Turkey taking the pulse of the new EU plan sending migrants back to Turkey. Thanks very much, Daniela. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot, Marco.
Coming up, what do you wear to a dinner featuring slow food? Slow fashion, of course, here on The World. You may have heard of the slow food movement, you know, local ingredients prepared with care and time. Now there's something called slow fashion. The people who believe in it say it's focused on clothes that are built to last and easier on the environment. Here's The World's Jason Margolis.
Meet British fashion designer Tom Cridland.
I'm really someone who had no fashion or business background. I'm a 25-year-old designer now, but I really got into the fashion world because I've always been entrepreneurial.
Here's his latest entrepreneurial idea: T-shirts, sweatshirts, and jackets that are guaranteed to last for 30 years.
If at any point something happens to any of these garments, if they rip or tear, we repair them free of charge.
How do you do that? Because my T-shirts, after a few years, they start to fray. Some get holes in them. How are your T-shirts not going to do that?
Where do you buy your T-shirts from?
The Gap, something like that.
Gap is a fast fashion brand, and I'm not in this business to get bitchy, but at a certain point, production costs come into it.
The cotton Cridlin uses comes from northern Italy, and his clothes are stitched together in Portugal.
So as you can see, I'm wearing a jacket now, and you can see that the seams have been double reinforced by hand. They're put together by craftsmen who know actually what they're doing, which is expensive.
Cridlin has no physical stores. He sells his products online only. His fashion models are his fairly normal-looking buddies and his brother. All this lowers his costs significantly, so he can sell his T-shirts for $55. Before you say, hold on, that's a lot for a T-shirt, consider what other high-end T-shirts cost these days.
You know, I looked at Yves Saint Laurent the other day. They're selling T-shirts for $300. It's quite staggering.
I fact-checked that and found one selling for $600. Cridlin argues that his garments are of the same quality. Cridlin's 30-year guarantee is a marketing strategy, but it's also about helping the environment. That's the main pitch over at Zadie, a new women's fashion label selling, quote, sustainable garments. Maxine Beda is a co-founder.
We chose natural materials. It's kind of exclusively what we work with at Zadie because they have a much lower carbon footprint, and also they biodegrade, which is not something that synthetic material does. It takes 200 to 400 years to decompose.
Many polyesters, which are made from fossil fuels, also use toxic dyes that can be released into rivers in places like China. It's estimated that up to 20% of industrial water pollution comes from treating apparel. More clothing also means more greenhouse gases through production and transportation. And all of those cheap clothes mean poorly paid workers in often unsafe factories. Beda says Zadie's business model stands against throwaway fast fashion culture.
Women today are wearing their clothing only 7 times before getting rid of it, which is kind of, it's boggling to the mind to think about.
That's according to a recent British survey of 2,000 women. Beda wants clothing shoppers to start acting like owners, not consumers.
You own a house. You own your stove. You own your clothing. You consume your vegetables.
But how long can clothes indeed last? I met with Adam Bromby in Stockholm. He owns the Swedish company Woolpower. He shows me the terry loop stitching on some of their socks.
And it looks like a towel, for example. And what this does is the terry loops also attracts air.
I was skeptical. Socks are socks, right? Bromby gave me a $20 pair to try. And I gotta say, and I never ever thought I'd say something like this, I look forward to days when I wear his socks. I asked Bromby if he'd guarantee his clothes, including jackets and turtlenecks, for 30 years. His answer? No.
Because you don't know. I mean, if you wear a sweater every single day for 2 years, of course you're going to wear it and tear it. You're going to destroy it after a while.
There's one other big question I had about long-term fashion promises. Will the garments stay in fashion? What if you bought high-end pleated pants 10 years ago? Tom Cridlin says his clothes aren't hyper-trend driven to guarantee longevity.
White T-shirts, navy sweatshirts. We try and make the basics really well. We try and make wardrobe staples that people are going to want in 30 years.
That said, you can also buy items with a little more flair, but buyer beware.
And we can't guarantee that you'll look good in a bright turquoise jacket in 30 years. That's your call, but I know I'm going to look good in a bright turquoise jacket in 30 years, so I'll be wearing mine.
He's already made clothing for actors Leonardo DiCaprio, Hugh Grant, and Daniel Craig. Hey, if it's fashionable enough for James Bond, probably fashionable enough for the rest of us, too. For The World, Jason Margolis, New York City.
Here's another story about fashionable items that caught our eye. I'm not talking about clothes. This is something called the Finnish Baby Box. The box was developed in Finland as a way to help new parents and their kids. But now, according to our colleagues at the BBC, the Baby Box has caught on across the globe as a for-profit venture. We wanted to find out how this Baby Box got started, so we called up Heikki Titanen, one of the co-founders of the Finnish Baby Box company.
So in the 1930s, the Finnish government invented the Finnish Baby Box. And the main idea was to get all the women to visit the doctor or a maternity clinic. At first, it was for only the low-income families. And later on, it was broadened to so that every new family in Finland will receive the box.
And how would you explain the way this box in Finland has reduced childhood mortality?
Yeah, really, it's about maternity clinics. So the box serves like a product that will drive people to the maternity clinic. So in Finland, parents still today receive a box full of baby essentials from the Finnish government.
And that's also, free, correct?
Yes, that's free.
What's in that box still?
There's indoor clothes, four sizes. So babies grew through four sizes during the first year. There's outdoor clothes. And then there's the bed box that can be used as the first bed for the baby and all the bed clothes, as well as the hygiene products and bath products to keep the baby clean. So we've created a consumer product.
I'm just curious, I mean, does it bother you that an idea that's emerged from essentially social welfare in Finland, addressing issues like childhood mortality, that it's now a for-profit enterprise for other places around the world?
Yeah, how we see it is really that the product itself offers so great help to new parents that probably all the countries around the world should provide to their citizens. But unfortunately, that's not the case. So we want to offer it for those who are not able to receive it from their own country.
You know, Heikki, it's kind of funny. Here we are, two guys talking about what babies and, you know, mothers need in
yes.
the first months. What kind of input have you gotten on what ought to be in the Finnish box, the baby box, from women in Finland?
Well, our wives, of course, has had a great influence on what to have it. And we actually, all three of us had new babies last year, so we have our own baby testing unit that we've tested a lot of different items and especially clothes.
Heikki Titanen, one of the founders of the Finnish Baby Box Company. Thanks very much and good luck to you.
Thank you.
By the way, Titanen's company sells a baby box for between $450 and $680 here in the U.S., but he says his company cuts that price for families who are not able to afford it. Coming up, remembering one cool jazz cat, Gatto Barbieri, on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Nigeria's military has freed hundreds of women once held captive by Boko Haram militants. Many had been forced to marry their captors. But after being freed, they're still known as Boko Haram wives.
And they realized not long after being taken out of captivity that they were not seen as victims, they were seen as suspects.
That story is just ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The Nigerian military has been touting its recent successes against Boko Haram. Officials say many of the thousands of women and girls who had been held hostage by the militant group have been freed. But that is not the end of the story. As the Washington Post's Kevin Sieve puts it, there have been few joyous family reunions for these victims. I spoke with him earlier today via Skype. Start, if you would, by telling us about two young women you met, one now 15, the other 25. Hamsatu and Halima, what did they tell you about their capture and the conditions they were living in?
Yeah, so Hamsatu and Halima are from a city called Bama in northeastern Nigeria, a city of about 350,000. In September 2014, Boko Haram fighters came to the city, killed probably hundreds of men, and kidnapped at least dozens of women, including Hamsatu and Halima. They took them to the Sambisa forest, put them in very small huts, where for about 7 months they were used as sex slaves, and almost every day they were raped. Hamsatu was 25 years old. She became pregnant about 2 months into captivity. You know, they were just kept there in these huts for 7 months. They didn't know if they were going to be killed because they'd seen so many people just shot at that point. They tried to escape. Hamsatu tried to escape 5 times. Each time she was caught by Boko Haram guards and brought back to her hut, and then again just violently raped. And then about 7 months into captivity, the Nigerian military staged this big, what they call rescue operation, but it was incredibly violent. The Nigerian military burned down a number of huts while the women were still inside. They were shooting wildly. A number of the women who were held hostage by Boko Haram were actually either killed or disappeared in the process of this rescue operation. But Hamsatu and Halima luckily survived. They were taken by Nigerian soldiers to what's called a displacement camp, but is really just a series of abandoned buildings in the middle of the Nigerian desert, so just scorching heat. And they realized, you know, not long after being taken out of captivity, that they were not seen as victims. They were seen as suspects. They were seen as members of Boko Haram, affiliates of this terrorist organization.
Why were they approached in that kind of attitude?
In part, it stems from a sort of traditional belief in northeastern Nigeria that after spending so much time with militants, after being raped by militants, that they have a sort of bond or a sort of sympathy for the terrorist organization, which is obviously very hard for lots of us to understand because these women were being victimized and not necessarily, you know, sympathetic. But that is part of that is a traditional belief. And the other part is that sort of inexplicably over the last 2 years, many, many women and girls have been used as suicide bombers in northeastern Nigeria. And it's unclear exactly how they're coerced, whether some people say they're drugged, some people say they're brainwashed, some people say, you know, they're given the choice of either being shot or strapping themselves with explosives. But for whatever reason, almost 50% of the suicide bombers in Nigeria in 2015 were women. Of those women, almost half of them were girls under the age of 18. So the Nigerian military now, when they see female victims of Boko Haram, they sort of immediately suspect, oh, well, this woman, this girl could be a suicide bomber. And they're treated as such even after they're vetted, even after they're going to counseling. There's almost no way that they can prove their innocence. And so, you know, Halima and Hamsatu have been free for about a year now. You know, they're just living in this very small tent where they never get enough food. You know, Hamsatu is raising the child of her rapist.
And the psychological counseling that the Nigerian government is providing, is that adequate?
No, it's certainly not. I mean, Hamsatu and Halima go to a counseling session about once a week. The person who is leading the session is herself a victim of Boko Haram, which is, you know, not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think she shares the experience. She knows the right questions to ask, but she's not a trained counselor. She's not a trained therapist. She's just a young woman who, like the rest of these victims, is trying to sort of work out what to do with the rest of her life. Beyond that, there's really no psychosocial support accessible to these women.
I mean, the way the Nigerian military rescued these girls, too, and you mentioned this earlier, it really doesn't sound as if they understand fully what these women and girls have been up against. Is the Nigerian military really deeply engaged in this fight against Boko Haram and getting these young women out?
I don't think that willingness to fight the insurgency translates to a real recognition of the human rights conditions in the area. And so, you know, the fighters are certainly more active than they were 2 years ago. But I think the entire war is seen strictly in security terms and not at all in terms of massive humanitarian crisis that it really is. I mean, we're talking about more or less 3 million displaced people. And the Nigerian military isn't really concerned about displacement as much as it's concerned about defeating Boko Haram in some kind of military sense.
Washington Post reporter Kevin Seif speaking with us from Mogadishu about his recent trip to northern Nigeria. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
One note to add, we reached Kevin in Mogadishu, Somalia, in East Africa, where he's reporting right now, and that quickly became part of our Nigeria interview with Kevin.
In 2014, Boko Haram came to Bama, killed probably hundreds of men. Oh, Jesus. Sorry.
What was that?
That was a gunshot.
Are you okay?
Yeah, no, I'm fine. I'm just in Mogadishu, so there's random gunshots sometimes. It's fine. But if you wouldn't mind, can I take that question again?
Yeah. Yeah, we did take the question again, and that's the interview you heard earlier. But at the end of our chat, I had to ask Kevin about that gunshot and about the level of violence in Mogadishu. Here's what he told me.
You know, there are lots of guys with guns. I'm not sure. I suspect it was just someone messing around. But actually, I mean, Mogadishu is an incredibly tense place at the moment. The president's villa yesterday was mortared quite seriously. So who knows? I hear some guys talking now, and it sounds like they're laughing. So hopefully it's not too serious.
It's all part and parcel, Kevin Seif told me, of reporting from a war zone. Back to our top story today, the so-called Panama Papers. It's a huge leak of documents from a Panamanian law office called Mossack Fonseca. The documents allegedly show how clients of the firm use Panama as a haven for tax evasion, money laundering, even arms and drug deals. Mossack Fonseca seems to have quite the clientele, all manner of the rich and famous and more than one world leader, including Prime Minister Gunnlaugsson of Iceland. In the past, he's urged Icelanders to keep their money in the country as it recovers from the economic crash of a few years back. But the leaked papers show he and his wife bought a company in the British Virgin Islands in 2007, allegedly to hide money. We spoke with Paul Fontaine, news editor at the Reykjavik Grapevine, about the public outcry that's erupted.
Whether or not he broke any laws is very possible. It really depends on your interpretation of the law. As you said, he and his wife did set up this company, Winters Incorporated, in Tortola in the British Virgin Islands. When he came into Parliament in 2009, 8 months later, he had sold his share, his 50% share in this company to his wife for $1. And this sale was made exactly one day before a bill was passed into law that had more strict requirements for members of Parliament to register their vested interests. Now, he contends that his particular vested interest did not technically fall under the category that was listed in law at the time, before and after the passage of this new law, but not everyone sees it that way. But the bigger question really is, why is the prime minister, why had he for years been acting in contradiction to his own economic policies? And why did he keep all this to himself until he was forced to reveal his interests?
Yeah, so how is the prime minister defending himself?
Not very well,
Has there been any reaction from his office?
Well, in an interview he gave today, he apologized for this now infamous interview that a lot of people have seen where he got very defensive and he walked out of the interview. Well, this morning he apologized for his behavior during the interview, but he emphasized, you know, I don't think I did anything wrong. I reported all my money to the tax company and I have no intention of resigning.
What's the kind of general attitude in Iceland to the whole idea of tax shelters?
Well, even the prime minister himself has spoken out against them. That's part of what is so galling to the Icelandic public about this. I mean, this is the man who has been touting the strength of the Icelandic krona, our currency here. He's encouraged people to keep their money in the country. He's enforced capital controls on us. And the fact that he's just pretty much disregarded all of this in his personal financial dealings has made people absolutely furious. Like, I don't think people are as concerned with the letter of the law as they are just general ethics.
So even if the prime minister has done something that is, in fact, legal, are Icelanders kind of willing to let him slide on this one, or are they really that upset?
They appear to be incredibly angry. In the years that I've covered this coalition government, I've never seen this type of groundswell of rage, not just because of this, but because of so many other things that have happened before it, that this is kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back. There's also the fact that a petition that's been circulating calling for the prime minister's resignation has just over 25,000 signatures, bearing in mind that Iceland is a country of 320,000 people. It's a significant chunk of the population that are calling for his resignation.
So how do you see this ending, Paul?
Well, the most telling thing of all is that his partner in the ruling coalition, the Minister of Finance, Bjarni Benediktsson, it's more like what Bjarni has not said. Like, he was asked point blank, do you think the prime minister is fit to continue his office? And he would not answer, which is very telling. And from what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing, members of the Independence Party, who themselves are not completely clean, kind of look at Sigmundur Davíð as a weight around their necks. And it seems like they're washing their hands of him. And I really wouldn't be surprised if, even if the prime minister doesn't resign himself, the Independence Party themselves want to form a new coalition.
You know, being ground zero for the economic crash in 2008 was humiliating enough for a lot of Icelanders. But what does this now do to Iceland's reputation as, you know, a success story post-2008? Does it start to look as corrupt as a lot of places?
ironically enough, I think a lot of Icelanders are hoping that, because one of the things that's been very frustrating for us is that there's been a lot of very starry-eyed reports about Iceland's economic miracle and its bounce back, when a lot of the major players, including our own elected officials, are still very much corrupt and very much embroiled in unethical, if not illegal, economic practices. And so I think there's a hope amongst many Icelanders that the rest of the world does know this, that they do pay attention, and that it helps put pressure upon this government to dissolve.
Paul Fontaine, news editor at the Reykjavik Grapevine, speaking with us from Reykjavik. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
When you read about some of the people implicated in the Panama Papers, from actor Jackie Chan to the father of British Prime Minister David Cameron to Vladimir Putin's good friend the cellist we heard about earlier, we could have spent the whole hour going E! True Hollywood Story on this. But let's focus on just one celebrity for a moment, Lionel Messi. He's one of the most well-known, well-paid soccer players on the planet. And for that, I turn to the world soccer guy, William Troop.
This comes at a really interesting time because Lionel Messi has developed his soccer career in Spain, in Barcelona, and he has been under investigation in Spain for tax fraud, and he's facing a trial. So what's wrong with this picture? Basically, that Messi looks like he and his father, because his father is involved in this sort of offshore shell game that is revealed in this leak. They've basically set up a company in Panama called Megastar Enterprises, which serves as a place to park Messi's money so that it's not taxed back home in Spain.
Yeah, I mean, this is a heck of a preamble to that trial. Could these revelations impact that case, that trial?
I think very much so. One of the things that's going to come out in that case is that the timing of the purchase of this offshore company by Messi and his father is kind of dubious, doesn't look very good. It turns out that Lionel Messi's father reportedly filed the paperwork to buy this company in Panama the day after Spanish authorities officially unveiled their tax fraud case against Messi. So, yeah, the timing is pretty suspicious there.
Okay, so Messi for Messi, and then there's this dirty business in the Panama Papers that reveal a connection between this law firm in Panama, Mossack Fonseca, and FIFA's ethics committee, FIFA being the governing body of world soccer. Explain that one, William.
That couldn't come at a worse time for world soccer, when FIFA's trying to say, look, we got rid of the old guys who were corrupt. We're starting again. We have this like great ethics committee. And what did the Panama Papers reveal? That one of the members of the ethics committee at FIFA right now is involved in setting up shell companies offshore in Panama for all kinds of people. But especially what's troubling for FIFA is that this official, Juan Pedro Damiani, he's from Uruguay, has a long history of doing business with another former FIFA official, Eugenio Figueiredo, who was a vice president at FIFA. And Figueiredo was one of the FIFA officials who was arrested last May in Zurich for corruption. He has been extradited to Uruguay. He has been indicted in the U.S. for accepting bribes. And the latest in his case is that he has reportedly admitted to accepting bribes and is negotiating to try to get a lesser sentence. So what's troubling there is that you have a figure within FIFA in charge of ethics who did not disclose any of this when these indictments came out. So it's yet another layer of not very transparent business going on at an organization that is still trying to clean up its act.
Yeah, again, only going to complicate things for this struggling organization, I imagine. I can't leave, William, without returning to that name of Messi's company that you mentioned earlier, Megastar Enterprises. I mean, that's certainly flaunting it, and now it seems maybe a little humility would have been in order.
Well, I have to say, I'm not sure he wanted us to know the name, but here we are, we know the name. That, again, goes against his squeaky clean image as a very nice guy.
Well, and also a humble guy, right?
Yeah. And for the record, Lionel Messi is not the only player who reportedly has offshore accounts and who's had shady dealings in terms of where he puts his money. It happens a lot. There are several in Europe being investigated. Messi's teammate in Barcelona, Neymar, the famous Brazilian superstar, is also facing allegations that he hasn't been completely transparent with his earnings. So I think this is a problem that goes beyond Messi and affects a lot of the big money that is made in world soccer.
Well, and not only in soccer, billions of tax dollars that could have been doing something else. The world soccer guy, William Troop, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Coming up, a little tribute to Argentine jazz legend Gato Barbieri, and that time he played sexy tango. Stay with us here on The World. We've told you lots of stories on the world about refugees from Syria, but the refugees in this next story are different. These are Syrians who joined ISIS and later defected and fled to Turkey. Washington-based reporter Rasha Ilas spoke with two researchers, one American and one Turkish, who have been interviewing Syrian ISIS defectors via Skype. She starts with the story of one young Syrian who is now in Turkey.
Omar is a runaway, but what he ran to was unusually harsh. He's speaking on a scratchy Skype connection.
Military training starts 7 a.m. and goes until sundown. Then from sundown to evening prayer, that's when we go to Sharia lessons.
Last year, when Omar was 13, ISIS came to his town of Ras El Ain near the Turkish border. He thought they were real warriors and would give him a sense of pride and purpose.
We spent 1 month training in this military camp. Its name was the Sheikh Abu Musab al-Zarqawi camp.
But he soon learned that he and the other kids were being trained to carry out suicide attacks. He met boys who later died that way. ISIS called them buttons, he says, because pushing a button would be the last thing the boys ever did. So he decided to run away again, this time risking his life to get away from ISIS. Omar is not his real name, but his ordeal is typical of many Syrian ISIS defectors. He's in hiding in Turkey, where he knows ISIS can still find and kill him, and he worries that Turkish authorities will come after him. This is why it's so difficult to get ISIS defectors to talk openly about their ordeal. This is where Ahmet Yayla comes in. He lives in the U.S. now, but he was a chief of counterterrorism in Turkey, and now he uses his contacts back home to interview ISIS defectors like Omar via Skype.
So it's 25, actually.
I think it's 26. She counts.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
His partner on the research is Anne Speckhard, a psychologist and terrorism expert at Georgetown. She estimates she's interviewed hundreds of terror suspects from different backgrounds and religions. And she tells me ISIS recruitment stands out for its brutality. For instance, the men can only graduate from their mandatory Sharia training if they prove their commitment.
We had one ISIS defector who told us he had the knife in his hand and he was going to behead his prisoner. And then he realized this is a real human being and he threw the knife down and ran away. They arrested him. They put him in ISIS prison, and then they recycled him through Sharia training again.
The recruits aren't just men. Umm Muhammad worked in the group's vice police unit, ensuring that women adhered to the strict Islamic dress code. She says many of the higher-ups in ISIS are foreigners, even in the women's sphere, and they're in charge of punishing Syrians whom they deem to be un-Islamic. That breeds resentment, she says.
We are all Muslims. But we still have to follow their rules. Like when Syrian women go out to farm the lands, ISIS forbids them and demands they wear a full niqab while farming, which is very difficult, but there's no choice.
Umm Muhammad says she and her husband joined ISIS in Raqqa, the group's de facto capital in Syria. At first, she says, they believed ISIS would bring order and justice, but they grew disillusioned. They stuck it out, though, because of the perks. ISIS gave them a house to live in and salaries.
I got $150 per month. We lived better than Syrians who didn't join ISIS. We ate roasted chicken and lamb.
Yayla says that's a common story for Syrians under ISIS rule.
One guy told us that he couldn't feed his family, so he had to join ISIS. We even heard about the girls at the age of 13, 14, 15, who thought that they had to get married to ISIS fighters so that they could provide some food for their families.
When her husband was killed in the fighting, Umm Muhammad knew ISIS would pressure her to marry one of their fighters. So she fled across the border to Turkey with her siblings and parents, where they're all in hiding. As for Omar, the former child soldier, he survives by picking cotton in Turkey. During his Skype interview, he says he's homesick. Asked what he would tell other young men who were thinking of joining, I would tell them not to go, he says. ISIS is not good. They will only tell you lies. For The World, I'm Rasha Ilas.
Finally today, Gatto Barbieri was a cool cat. And it wasn't just his sunglasses and trademark fedora that made you think he had nine lives. It was actually his slinking from club to club in his native Buenos Aires, scooping up late-night jazz gigs that earned him the nickname that stuck with him for the rest of his life. That life ended on Saturday at the age of 83. Considering Gatto Barbieri was Argentine, it's a bit surprising that the most overt take we got from him of Argentina's most iconic music was in a movie, Last Tango in Paris. Gatto's semi-raunchy sax there from Last Tango in Paris. Last Tango was the way many obit writers reminded us of what Gatto Barbieri did, but that doesn't give you his full genius. In part, he was selected to score the music and perform on the Last Tango soundtrack because of the way he reinterpreted jazz through a Latin lens, taking the Charlie Parker obsession with Latin jazz in a new direction. And in Gatto's mind, that new direction had no limits, as he showed in 1977. That's Gatto Barbieri doing his thing over Carlos Santana's guitar on the classic Europa. Both Europa and Last Tango in Paris make it clear that Gatto Barbieri brought a sexiness to a lot of the music he made. To cop a phrase from the jazz songbook, Gatto Barbieri led a lush life. We'll leave you with a track from Last Tango that he composed and plays on. It's lush, it's tango, it's jazzy, it's total Gatto Barbieri. Tip of the fedora to the late, great Gatto Barbieri. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Public Radio International.